content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Black workers' wages finally starting to rise, and Chapel Hill launches court debt fund for poor and minorities. And we'll begin with Black workers' wages finally starting to rise. On a brisk January morning, Marcus Mitchell arrives at his desk at 8:30, his phone ringing before he can even log into his computer. An employee at the giant nonprofit where Mitchell works is locked out of the organization's network and needs the 24-year-old's help. Mitchell came, a full-fledged employee at JEVS Human Services in Philadelphia in October, after a year as an apprentice. Just 3 years ago, he was making $13,000 working in the kitchen at a Chick-fil-A, feeling unsure about his future. Landing the $38,000 a year position was the latest step in a rapid career ascent made possible in part by America's long economic expansion and low unemployment rate. President Donald Trump frequently celebrates the experience of Black workers, noting correctly that the group's unemployment rate is at its lowest on record. Their wages are also going up. A New York Times analysis of government data found that wage growth for Black workers has accelerated recently after lagging for much of the decade-long economic expansion. But when Mitchell looks around his relatively low income and heavily Black neighborhood, he worries that the rising tide of a strong economy has not been equally good for everyone in his community. And when it comes to his own labor market gains, he's working hard to make sure they do not prove fleeting. A malignant reality lurks beneath the happy surface as Black workers finally make job market progress. Not only did the gains take a decade of steady job growth to materialize, but they could evaporate at the first sign of economic weakness, as they did after previous expansions. In April 2017, Mitchell quit his low-paying job, hoping that he could achieve a better life. By June that year, he was in a training program, one that helped connect him to another backed by JEVS. That led to a pre-apprenticeship role in partnership with AmeriCorps, and then apprenticeship and now his full-time job. He has one certification and is working on another in networking and could even progress to a cybersecurity test down the road. He's conscious that without a college degree, he has challenges, but hopeful that his on-the-job experience and practical training will help him weather future downturns. I know that the fact that I don't have a degree puts me at a disadvantage over my peers, he said. I've gained enough knowledge to go and do computer work for people myself, so if that's what I had to do, I'd do it. He has lived in his home, which is subsidized, since his family ran into hard times around the last recession. His mother, a teacher, had to take time off work after a bad car accident and then struggled to find new work as the economy reeled. The boys were interested in college, but for Mitchell, high school changed that. He felt that his teachers did not care about him, especially after concerns about building safety forced his high school to shut down before his senior year. Fights plagued the hallways of his new school. There were cages on the windows. He cut classes, sneaking out a side door to the freedom of the surrounding city. Though an avid reader, he failed English. He was pushed through graduation anyway. He worked in poison ivy removal and had a short stint at UPS before starting work at Chick-fil-A, where he made $9.50 an hour. He promised himself the job would be short-lived and spent his mornings and nights reading computer-related training material. But more than a year in, as he was cleaning the floors at Chick-fil-A, a moment shook him. "I was squeegeeing water up, and these guys walked in," he said. "They were technicians, sent there to fix the restaurant's computer network. They were close to his age, and he couldn't help comparing their work with his own. I just told myself, here's the risk, here's the reward. What are you going to do?" I knew computers and people with skills in computers were in demand. I knew in my heart, he said, but at the same time, who is going to pick this kid up with no college degree and no experience? His timing was ideal. The shortage of qualified workers in information technology is prompting employers to cast a wider net, fueling demand for apprenticeship programs like the one he completed. Mitchell has made huge gains in the past few years, but he still doesn't have a college degree. He is hoping that his certificate and experience make up for that, but they have yet to be tested in the crucible of a recession. What happens to Mitchell and others like him has implications for the broader economy. Historically, the gains made during periods of low unemployment have proved transitory for black workers, who are among the last to benefit from a good economy and among the first to suffer in a downturn. But there have been a few past examples of a labor market as strong and sustained as the current one. Some economists hope that as more workers like Mitchell get a foothold in the labor market, the larger pool of workers would leave the American economy better off in the long run. And next, Wake may delay its school bond vote. Wake County voters might not be asked to approve a school construction bond referendum this year, even though that would mean using a more expensive way to pay for school projects. Wake County staff recommended Friday waiting until 2022 to put the next school construction bond referendum on the ballot because of how many items already will be on the November 2020 ballot. Instead of a bond referendum this year, officials want to use an alternative borrowing method that would cost a half cent more on the property tax rate. Commissioner Vicki Adamson said that half cent difference would only mean $15 more a year in property taxes on a home with a $300,000 assessed property value. "The difference is basically no cost to homeowners, which we love," Adamson said at Friday's retreat planning meeting. Wake County voters last approved a school bond in 2018 when they overwhelmingly backed borrowing $548 million. That year, voters also approved borrowing $349.1 million for Wake Tech Community College projects and $120 million for parks, open space, and recreation construction. Growth has slowed since 2018 in the Wake County school system, with planners pointing to issues such as an aging population, fewer children being born, and competition from other school options. Enrollment projections released this week have the district growing by 33 students this fall and 1,177 students by fall 2026. But school leaders say there are still many older schools that need renovations. They also point to how some areas lack seats because growth is still occurring there. Our school buildings that the taxpayers have paid for are still going to age, Greg Ford, chairman of the Board of Commissioners, said in an interview. They need to be reinvested in to make sure that they are at the standards we want students and teachers to have. We still have to build schools in high growth areas. Under state law, Wake County can only hold bond votes in years with an election where all the polling places are open at once. During odd number years, individual Wake cities and towns don't all vote on the same day. That means that if there's no bond vote this year, then the county leaders would have to wait until 2022. In 2016, the school system and county agreed to create a 7-year construction program that's updated annually. The assumption had been that there would be $594 million school bond referendum on this year's ballot. The county has the option of using general obligation bonds, which require voter approval but have lower interest rates because the borrowing is backed by the county's taxing authority. Another option is to use limited obligation bonds, which don't require a referendum and are backed by county assets, making them more expensive. County staff say that using the limited obligation bonds would result in minimal cost difference of a half cent more on the property tax rate beginning in 2024. They also say there would be no difference in the amount of money available for the school projects. If a bond referendum was held this year, county staff said there would be ballot crowding in November because of the presidential, state, and local elections. Raleigh may also put housing and parks bonds on the fall ballot. Commissioner Sig Hutchinson said the cost difference between the two options is minimal and that not putting a school bond on the ballot would help Raleigh's bond efforts. We are part of a county with partners, and particularly with the city of Raleigh, I think they have been great partners with what they're trying to do, Hutchinson said. I think that's important in terms of giving them the greatest opportunity to be successful. Ford said that he's also leaning toward using the limited obligation bonds, but he said that helping Raleigh should be secondary to making sure that the school needs are met. We do want to be mindful of similar efforts of our municipal partners doing things that are in line with our goals, like affordable housing and parks and open space, Ford said. But in my opinion, I don't know that this decision should be based on what one municipality or another is going to do. Commissioners agreed Friday to hold on a decision until March. This will give them time to talk with the school board first. We want to make sure our colleagues on the school board are comfortable with the budget assumptions, that we can cross-check the capital needs as we see them, and just make sure we're all on the same page, said Ford, a former Wake principal. And next, Chapel Hill launches court debt fund for poor minorities. A speeding ticket for some is a little more than an inconvenience easily resolved by an attorney. For others, it can mean a choice between paying court costs and fees or the rent. Andrea McSwain faced that choice when she started getting her life together a few years ago. At 15, her abusive boyfriend would make her drive when they got high, she said. She got tickets for speeding, driving without a license, and other charges. I'll never forget that one night I got pulled over with a busted lip, McSwain said. Instead of the officer asking me what happened, am I okay, I got a ticket for speeding. I got a ticket for having no license or registration, and I had to end up paying for it when I got my license. At 28, the single mother with four children graduated from Orange County's Family Treatment Court and started the UNC Horizons program, where she kicked her drug habit. The tickets popped up when she applied for a license, over $2,000 in fines, fees, and court costs, and she knew the paychecks from her restaurant jobs weren't enough. She took out a loan to cover the tickets, paying roughly $100 a month. Other speeding tickets followed, and her already high insurance premiums rose again when another driver hit her car. When she bought another car, she thought the registration was included in the loan payments. It was not, and she was hit with a $235 bill to get her registration fixed. In February, she hopes the district attorney will dismiss the charge, leaving her to pay just the court cost. At 33, McSwain estimates she has paid at least $4,000 in court costs and fees over the last 5 years on top of the fines for her tickets. She readily admits her responsibility, but also thinks high court costs and fees are keeping people in poverty from succeeding. It's still a struggle, McSwain said. I don't like taking sick days. If I don't have comp time, sick leave, anniversary leave, or something, I don't take off work. I literally cannot afford to miss work because I'm the only one paying the bills. A pilot $20,000 criminal justice debt fund the Chapel Hill Town Council approved this month could help people like McSwain. The fund is for town residents who have nonviolent criminal or traffic offenses and are going to work or school, getting drug treatment, or taking other steps toward a more stable life. Beth Vasquez with Chapel Hill Police Department Crisis Unit will manage the program, working with local courts, law enforcement, and community groups, including the Interfaith Council for Social Services and Community Empowerment Fund, to identify clients and provide help. Approved payments will go to the court system or the NC Division of Motor Vehicles. The program is a way to address systemic injustice in the courts, Council members Karen Stegman, Alan Busani, and Michael Parker said in proposing the idea. Here we are again with an opportunity to help another vulnerable part of our community, said Busani, a civil rights attorney. People who have served their time and are trying their best to reintegrate into society, to become productive members of society, to be providers for their family, to ultimately contribute to the fabric of what makes Chapel Hill great. In 2017, a report, Court Fines and Fees, Criminalizing Poverty in North Carolina, UNC law professor and Poverty Authority Jean Nickel and research associate Heather Hunt noted that roughly 10 million people nationwide owe over $50 billion, an average of $5,000 each, in criminal justice debt. In North Carolina, the list of fees possible in criminal cases is unusually long and growing, they reported. The situation is leaving lower-income defendants and families at a higher risk for a long-term debt, jail time for minor offenses, and the loss of driver's licenses, wages, jobs, and homes, they said in the NC Poverty Research Fund report. Those on probation who fail to pay their fees and cost also can be denied public assistance, including for food and housing, they said. It's not just about criminal and social justice, said James Williams, the county's former chief public defender. It's also about racial justice. There are roughly 2.2 million people in U.S. jails and prisons today, a 500% increase since 1980, according to the Sentencing Project, a Washington, D.C.-based group. The number has soared since the 1980s war on drugs, it reported. Black men have a 1 in 3 chance of incarceration in their lifetimes, the Sentencing Project reported, compared with 1 in 17 white men and 1 in 6 Hispanic men. Black women also have the highest incarceration rate at 1 in 18, compared with 1 in 111 for white women and 1 in 45 for Hispanic women. Felony crimes can have other serious consequences, from hurdles to getting a job, college loans, or public assistance, to the loss of voting rights, which now affects 6.1 million Americans, including those who have served their time. The sad truth is it does prevent the very thing that as a system of justice we all say we want to see, Williams said. We want to see people back in society and contributing citizens, but these costs and fees quite often prevent that. In order to solve that, I firmly believe that all systems implicated in what we refer to as criminalization of poverty take a responsibility for being a solution to the problem. North Carolina's solution lies with the state legislature, which sets and steadily has increased court costs and fees. What used to be a $100 fee, Hunt told the council, is now $500, $700, or $1,000. Only some of the money collected by the local clerk of court is used to operate the courthouse, according to the NC Administrative Office of the Courts. Of the nearly $703 million collected from July 2018 through June 2019, over $249 million was deposited into the state's general fund, reports show. Most of the rest went to local governments, law enforcement, and other state agencies and citizens, including restitution and victims' compensation. The court system's budget was $553.2 million, or roughly 2.31% of the state's general budget. Chapel Hill gets about $25,000 a year to maintain the Franklin Street Courthouse, which shows, Stegman said, that the town has unwittingly participated in what is widely accepted to be an unjust system that has a disparate impact on the poor and on people of color. Other states are looking for solutions, including in Texas, where judges now can give low-income defendants community service instead of fines and fees. But Chapel Hill's program is unique in North Carolina, and other communities, including Durham, are waiting to see how it works, said Caitlin Finnegan, the county's criminal justice resource director. It's unclear how many people could be served in Chapel Hill, since no one tracks that data. The average court debt for roughly 350,000 people statewide is $500 per person, officials said. Finnegan noted that 2,000 people with Chapel Hill addresses had their driver's license revoked or suspended in 2018-19 for failing to pay court costs and fines. Many of them risk a charge of driving without a license because they still had to get to work or school. Faced with seemingly insurmountable debt, some then decided to ignore their tickets in court hearings. Every court hearing missed is another charge for failure to appear. While the debt fund is just a drop in the bucket, it does fill a hole in the countywide effort to help people with bail and legal debts, Finnegan said. Other efforts include the Orange County Bail Bond Justice Group, which kicked off in January 2019 at Olin T. Binkley Memorial Baptist Church in Chapel Hill. The group is raising money for a rotating $50,000 fund to help Orange County defendants who can't afford to get out of jail while awaiting trial. The money would pay up to $3,000 in bail and be returned to the fund after the person's court hearing. A GoFundMe campaign established to support the bail fund so far has raised $2,500 of its $25,000 goal. Another program, the Driver's License Restoration Project, gives Orange County judges the option of canceling court costs related to traffic tickets, and the local reentry council helps Orange County residents who have served their time get job training, housing, and other critical services for returning to the community. Although McSwain now works part-time as a court case manager and at her fiancé's roofing company, she still struggles to pay her court debts and loan while raising four children. She's grateful for her successes, hopeful the debt fund will help others to avoid the path that she has had to take. And next, Earth Fair workers sue for wages after closure. It all happened in quick succession. North Carolina-based grocery store chain Earth Fair announced Monday it was closing all of its stores. The next day, it filed for bankruptcy in Delaware. Now workers say the organic grocer didn't give its employees enough notice and their owed wages. According to a lawsuit filed Wednesday alongside Earth Fair's Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings, workers found out about the closings and mass layoffs at the same time as the public on February 3rd. The defendants violated the WARN Act by failing to give the plaintiffs and other similarly situated employees of the defendants at least 60 days advance written notice of termination, as required by the WARN Act, the complaint states. A representative for Earth Fair did not immediately respond to a request for comment from McClatchy News. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.